Hey, this is Jen Johans at FilmIntuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen. This week, I'm pleased to welcome back Natalie Jenner. Natalie Jenner is the USA Today an internationally best-selling author of the Jane Austen Society, Bloomsbury Girls, Every Time We Say Goodbye, and Austen at Sea, which have been translated into more than 20 languages worldwide. Her nonfiction writing on Jane Austen includes essays in Literary Hub and Paste magazine, as well as introductions to the Plumleaf Press editions of Lady Susan and Pride and Prejudice. Formerly a corporate lawyer, career coach, and independent bookshop owner, Natalie lives in Ontario, Canada with her family and two rescue dogs. Well, Natalie, I am thrilled to have you back. I love talking to you about, you know, the best years of our lives and those movies a few years ago, William Wyler. That was so much fun. So I know that Jane Austen is an area that we both love and that you are an expert in, of course. But how did you first come to Jane? Were you a fan your whole life? Was this adulthood?
Yeah, no, it started young. I was like 9 and I was a precocious reader and my parents had a lovely boxed edition of Pride and Prejudice. And I always say to everyone, if you're wondering what to start with, you can start with the movies. You can start with the books. Mm-hmm. But Pride and Prejudice is sort of like the gateway drug to Jane Austen. It's all in there, right? Everything that you're going to love about Jane Austen is in there in the most delightful, fresh, zippy, wonderful, efficient way and highly entertaining. And I remember loving it and that just like made me want more. And I was reading those other books always hoping to kind of find more of that hit of Darcy and Elizabeth and this like incredible hate to love trope that she essentially, I think, really invented, you know, unintentionally. And the movies when you run through the books, you very quickly need more of the hit. You go to the movies. And there's a lot of them. And the ones before the 1995 Pride and Prejudice TV series with Colin Firth, they're very staid. Yes. I don't mind that actually, because I'm old. Like I was born in the 60s. So I grew up with this. So I'm okay with that. Yeah. But what happens is you can tell them every 10 to 20 years, you could retell. People are like, do we need another? I'm like, yes. We can retell these stories because you never get the casting completely right. Every filmmaker, whether it's the screenwriter or the director or the actor, bring something new. And the stories are so well known at this point. So you're not watching them for suspense. But when you love Jane Austen, you do, I find, want to stay in her world as much as possible. So I've loved her my whole life. And now that I am, you know, in my late 50s, I find that I just, every time I read her books, even watching the movies for this podcast, I find new things to appreciate in terms of symmetry and catharsis and just what she was trying to do as a writer. And I'm a writer, I'm a novelist. So it really resonates with me when I see the choices that she makes. For example, with the movies we're going to talk about today, she really understood the first 40 pages rule that everyone who's, gets published, is lucky enough to get published. Generally speaking, you have to hook the agent, then the editor, and then the eventual readers within obviously the first, paragraph. And then the next bulk is sort of like the first 10 pages. And then after that, you have about 30 to 40 pages. And if you don't engage the reader by then, they put the book down. Like it's a loss. So she knew that. And what I love about the film adaptations is they're working with somebody who had all the right strangers come to town in the right amount of time. And it all happens like right when it should. And the proposals and the revelations of certain secrets take place right in the midpoint of the book, just like they should. And then you start building to your climax. She does literally a version of what Sid Field in his book Screenplay, which is one of my Bibles as a writer, talks about, that 19 minute in, mm-hmm. and then the 19 minute before the end. Like she really does sort of obey that a bit as a writer. Mm-hmm. And I find that the books and the movies work really well together. They really complement each other. And it's been, as someone who loves Jane Austen, it's just been like a plethora of, like, I feel very spoiled that there's just been so many, since I was in my early 20s, so many wonderful, especially
Yes.
feature film adaptations. Because before that, it was mostly Masterpiece Theater, PBS television, limited television type stuff. So yeah, that's why I love her, and I've loved her for a really long time. And I really love these movies that we're going to talk about.
Yes, I know. I don't think we're too far apart in age. I grew up also in the 80s, 90s, and beyond. And Jane was so popular. I remember one of my professors saying, a friend in New York who works in publishing had overheard at a party somebody ask who her agent was, Jane Austen. So didn't realize that these were older books, just
Yes.
thought she wrote historical fiction. So that's amazing. And it speaks to how, these stories kind of carry on, and they're slid into so many things like Bridget Jones' Diary. And you've got Mail has Pride and
Clueless.
Prejudice, Clueless has
Yeah.
Emma. I actually
Yeah.
think that's the best version of Emma.
Yeah, it's so wonderful.
And also, Bride and Prejudice, there's,
I love Pride and
probably,
Prejudice.
I love that one.
I
Yeah,
love it.
it's
It's so fun.
nobody brings it up. And so there's all of these really creative ones, like you were saying, for
Yeah.
sure. And
Yeah.
talking about the perfect script and how it's built, it reminded me of, I'm probably going to butcher her name and I apologize, so I'll just spell it. Deborah Moggach. Was it
I think it's
Magosh?
Mogosh.
Magosh.
Mogosh. I
Okay,
can't, yeah.
Magich, yes. When she was adapting Pride and Prejudice, she said she could actually break it down into like three perfect acts, essentially, and just how brilliant that was. And
Yeah.
yeah, I agree. I think Sense and Sensibility would have been far more daunting for Emma Thompson, especially it was her first feature. She'd written some shorter things, some comedic things, satirical, and some like solo work. But no. And so I think that was daunting. She had to simplify the language, she said, because Jane changed the way she wrote over the years, of course.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's been so good to see all of these different versions.
Yeah. And also with Sense and Sensibility, the screenplay story behind that is one of the most fascinating, because that is probably one of her early epistolary novels. So it was, we think, because everything got burned and we do not have existing early drafts of much of anything, usually just
Yes.
for, it's usually her unfinished novels, like The Watsons or What Became Sanditon, that will have some paper that she touched. And otherwise, once the books got published, the drafts went. And they think that Sense and Sensibility, and to some extent Pride and Prejudice, might have been written, like Lady Susan, as a series of letters. And
Yes.
so the result of that, especially with Sense and Sensibility, is that there's actually not a lot of lines of dialogue. And I think Emma Thompson's greatest, one of her great challenges with that story was there's a significant slowdown when they get to
Yeah.
London in the book. Like,
Yes.
I think a third of the book is from the time they arrive in London, until they go to Cleveland, where Marianne has her physical breakdown illness.
Yeah.
So I believe, and don't quote me on this, but it was in the dozens, like 40 pages, 40, like, it was like 40 pages of dialogue, or like total. It was very small amount for
Yeah.
her to work with. And the other thing about the Sense and Sensibility screenplay, for one more second on that, is that Emma Thompson very wisely knew that people were going to really respond to the cottage. And so
Yes.
half the movie takes place in the cottage. That's not the case of the book.
Mm-mm.
But she makes three major decisions, omissions, basically. And they are, like, one of them is my least favorite part of the book, which I actually dislike on an almost pathological level, which is when Marianne is dying and Willoughby shows up
Yes.
and
Yeah, I agree
uses
with you. Yep.
5% of the book. I count it because I'm so upset. I was like, how many freaking
Yes.
pages is this? And then my Kindle told me it was like 5%. I was like, wait, 5% of the book to basically, in some kind of narcissistic sociopathic way, get these women to like him again.
Yeah,
Not, he's
I
not genuinely contrite. He's just trying to restore his sense of feeling good about himself, his sense of ego, and his sense of power. And it is so dislikable. And you actually see Eleanor And again, this is through a narrative voice with her books, which we should talk about as well as the narrative voice in the books, which can't be in the movies and what that means for film.
Yes.
But, in the scene where he's justifying himself, Eleanor weakens a bit and softens a little bit towards him in a way that, is somewhat true to her character. But he is so blatantly off the charts with his narcissism that
Yeah.
although they wouldn't have known what that term is in those days, what Jane Austen does brilliantly is capture human behavior in every single aspect possible, even if it's just a town of 40 people. You're going to see every personality type. And she's really good at conveying to you in a very efficient way, distinct personality types and how they're, whether driven by their motives, et cetera. And Eleanor was not stupid, and her weakening towards Willoughby leaves both his behavior and then her softening to some small extent always leaves such a sour taste in my mouth. So I was so grateful that Emma Thompson took that out of the screenplay. She also took out two other things. She took out any mention, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong on this, Jen, of a duel taking place.
Oh, the duel is not in there. No.
The duel's not in there. And it's only mentioned in, honestly, a clause, like half of a sentence, like a throwaway clause in the book. And the other thing she doesn't do, and this is what I think is so brilliant about the screenplay, she moves up all the stuff about Edward when he comes to visit them at the cottage.
The first 20 minutes.
The first half hour or so
is
so delightful. And you want to stay in this world, which is, there's no Margaret Treehouse Atlas. Piracy is our only option. Like these delightful, charming, beyond charming lines that everyone can't wait to see. This is all Emma Thompson's brilliance because there's not a lot of dialogue to work with. And she moves stuff around in a way that I thought, I mean, I know why she won the Oscar because I do think it's probably one of the most difficult books, period, to adapt, let alone within Jane Austen. And man, do I love that screenplay. It's brilliant.
Yeah, Thompson actually at first suggested, let's do Persuasion or Emma, because she thought that they would be like a good place to start because Sense and Sensibility was so difficult. And exactly what you were saying, she said without the sequence, I think she said it was like 20 pages, 20 minutes of Edward at the beginning and what they're losing to end up in the cottage.
Yeah.
None of the rest of it actually works. And what's funny is I think that would be cut today. I think it would be chopped down to maybe 3 or 4 pages because they want to get to the action. The other thing with Sense and Sensibility is like what you were saying with the narcissism. She made all of the men better. On the page, they are not. I'm desperately in love with Alan Rickman's Colonel Brandon.
Oh, I know.
He's my favorite. But that's not the guy in the book. No.
No, it's not. And in fact, you know, she, the son-in-law, Hugh Laurie's character.
One of my favorite characters.
I mean, first of all, Hugh Laurie, I mean, obviously eminently likable, was like a Cambridge player
like
with
friend.
Emma Thompson, right? Like they like were friends and they were in this comedy troupe together. And every choice he makes, like when we watch that movie as a family and we watch it almost every year, we cannot wait to get to the parts where he comes on board, the parts of Margaret and Edward. Like these are they're so vital. And these are the actors also, right? That are doing, and I think Alan Rickman, especially, I get a little sad when I talk about him because I mean, when he says the air is full of spices and he says this in this most incredible, playful, adventurous way, that's not, like you said, that's not Colonel Brandon in the book, but what Emma Thompson so brilliantly does is get us to love him in that moment and want him to win. And I love, I hope that people who see this know the ending of the book, but I read recently and I love knowing this, that at the very end, when he tosses the coins in the air, the audiences in Japan, apparently were like losing their minds, like cheering and so happy. And that in the end is a big thing we get from Austen, which is there are these wonderful, happy endings. Often will be filmed with symmetry. Like the beginning will look a bit, the ending will look a bit like the beginning, involve the same characters. And it's really that moment of seeing somebody's stoicism and authenticity and this their humanity rewarded, getting everything their heart desires, is just such an incredible high. Like I remember when I went to see Sense and Sensibility, at the theater. I was a young lawyer. It feels like a very different life. I was a young lawyer in a big city, and I went with my mother. It came out kind of in the Christmas season or the lead up. And I remember afterwards, we just had to go get like ice cream and talk about it because candy cane ice cream and talk about it because we were like so on such a high the first time we saw them, the movie. And it builds to that high. And yeah, it's just, I think, a really gorgeous, and very winning film.
Yeah, I went really far away too. I remember because I lived in the Minneapolis suburbs and it was playing pretty far, but I went with my mom, of course. I was reading Sense and Sensibility at the time. I wasn't done yet. And I did notice the changes that when I
Yeah.
finished the book. But you were mentioning Hugh Laurie, of course. And one thing I learned doing a little research for this was at one point when writing the screenplay, she thought that she lost it completely. She had a computer failure and something
Yes.
happened, and she went over. She called Stephen Fry, the actor, who's a self-professed geek,
Yeah.
and so it took him like 7 hours,
Oh
and he
my
was
God.
able to finally recover. Like she thought she lost all of her work, he
Oh
found
my
it,
God.
and while he was doing that, Emma Thompson was having tea with Hugh Laurie, who just happened to be there. So it's kind of like kismet a little bit. Like you're going to be
Yes.
in this, yes, yeah. And I also love, I think Kate Winslet is amazing in the movie for sure. There's a different thing you love about it every time you watch.
Yeah.
And Emma Thompson, of course, was unusual casting and she didn't want to do that because she is too old for the
She
role,
is, yeah.
but they decided to age them up a little bit. I remember thinking that was a little strange at the time, but I love the cast so much and her delivering those lines is so sparkling. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's she, I mean, I think that with the behind the scenes story was I believe she was separated in her marriage to Kenneth Branagh, and I think
Yeah.
when she was writing this, it was, I just remember there's this lovely behind the scenes story as well that people that really love this movie know, which is that she met her husband now of 30 years, Greg
Yeah.
Weiss, who plays Willoughby of all people. I believe a gypsy or a fortune teller told Greg Weiss he would meet his wife on this movie. So he asked out Kate Winslet and they went out on a date and they're like, no, he's like, no, this is not her. And you can see the chemistry between the actors. Like you can see the chemistry between Emma Thompson and Greg Weiss in the movie. You can see
Yes.
the chemistry, like they light up. You can see the chemistry between Colonel Brandon and Marion, like Alan Rickman and I mean, obviously there's a huge age difference, but again, yeah, I thought Kate did an incredible job. In fact, I think it's that love story is probably really like, as much as we love Eleanor and want her to be happy, I do think that's the love story that we're really rooting for because that's the
Yes.
power of Rickman's performance and the way it's being written as well. And it's, yeah.
I know. I think one of my favorite scenes in film basically is when Colonel Brandon rides up to the house and he walks in as she's playing a
Yeah.
gorgeous song on the piano and just he's immediately struck. And
Yeah.
yes.
Yeah, I love that moment too, and it happens so early in the movie, and it's an important movement moment because it's visually depicting something that he's not, the narrative voice in Sense and Sensibility is not even going to cop to for a while,
No.
not let alone him in conversation with anybody, and so you see it. Whereas in the book, when he first hears Marion play, he's actually the only one that doesn't, she says, the narrator who doesn't go into raptures afterwards. He's
Yeah.
actually like reserving a little bit of praise and everyone else is falling all over her, which is another indication that he's trying not to notice her in a very Darcy and Elizabeth way. But yeah, that is a visual. That moment with the piano is so beautiful. She looks so beautiful. He looks so besotted. And it's just such an efficient way to kick off their love story. Yeah, it's a beautiful scene. And my favorite scene is in this version is what Oprah Winfrey, I think, said to Emma Thompson years ago when she had her on, which is like she said, this is like one of the best moments, which is when Edward shows up at the end and they all think that he's married to Lucy Steele and it turns out it's his
Oh.
brother and Emma Thompson collapses And that's when you go, yeah, they hired the right gal for this role, because she just completely collapses and ugly cries and loses her mind because she's realizing, oh, the man I love is free. And she literally can hardly hold in anymore all this emotion that she's been suppressing through the whole film in this really, really subtle, beautiful, and subdued way. She's never really shown her hand to anyone. And then she shows it more than anyone usually does. And it's such a funny, wonderful, charming moment. Yeah.
That's the moment I feel like it goes on a little long, but otherwise, yeah. But I do love that we finally see, because otherwise, and I think that's another thing Emma did great is strengthening the relationship between the sisters. So they have some of these conversations that they didn't have. But then we also see Emma processing things as Eleanor, and not letting Marianne know exactly what was happening before. And so, yeah, that is really good. I also love, the give me an occupation or I shall run mad. You
Yes.
know,
Yeah. Yeah.
that is a
Yeah.
great moment with Colonel Brandon. But yes, I think also the music, the look of the film, a lot of that is Ang Lee. I remember there was quite a lot of talk about they're hiring the guy that did Wedding Banquet,
Yeah.
the Taiwanese American filmmaker.
Yeah.
Like, what
Yeah.
is going on? And, you know, he talked about the fact that he wondered to himself, because English was not his first
Yeah.
language, and he grew up in Taiwan, and he said, because of that, I had a foot in feudal society, or a place where I was so oppressed that I was able to relate to these women who are oppressed and have to like depend on male relatives for, you know, land. Either you're basically land or marriage. That's it.
And yeah, like with he also did Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, I believe, as well.
Yes.
Wedding Banquet.
Yeah.
And I think those are the movies actually leading up to his being hired for this role. What's interesting is that he would go on to do Brokeback Mountain,
Which is
which is
amazing.
amazing movie. But similarly also dealing with social restriction
Yep.
and trying to be happy within such a restricted society, which is very Austen-esque and very much this story. So yeah, I think at the time it was just, I don't think anyone would have known who should be the director for this movie. Like, I don't think there would have been any
Yeah.
names. Sidney Pollack, ironically, I think might have been one of the
Yes.
producers. And I actually could have seen him doing this partly because of Out of Africa,
Yeah.
and Havana and a few other like really gorgeous sort of biopics or sort of period history that
Yep.
he had done. You know, I could see him bringing like a real beauty to that. Yeah, no, it's one of those movies that my family always wants to watch because it always makes us feel good. And that to me is what you want from a Jane Austen adaptation. You want to
Yeah,
capture that. Yeah.
exactly. And you brought up a really good point about repressing, and you know, it's also Crouching Tiger. We see that, and we see it in Lust Caution. So he's just always kind of returning to that. And he
Yeah.
said he actually really likes the romantic stories, and like, if I'm breaking someone's heart, I want it to be broken for 2 months.
Yes.
And so that's basically what he did in this at the end of Crouching Tiger and Brokeback Mountain as
Yeah,
well.
and I
Yeah.
mean I love I don't know if that's a hopeless or a hopeful romantic, but I love it
Yes.
when people own the fact that most of us do want a little bit of romance.
Oh,
Like,
yeah.
it's a big appeal for most people. You know, men or women, it doesn't really matter who you are. It's about seeing people yearn for something and get it. And there's only so many experiences in life that will ever have the power of that falling in love, is up there for most people. And so I think that Jane Austen knew the power of sexual attraction. She knew the power of falling in love with a bad boy, quote unquote.
Yeah.
She always has these disreputable, eventually disreputable, very charismatic, or
Yeah,
at
they're
least the
all,
characters think they're
yes.
charismatic, but every book has one. And he's sort of like,
Suave, yeah,
yeah. And he comes in, he
narcissistic.
narcissistic, and he enters and he kind of throws everything into a tempest in a teapot. One thing that I don't know, your listeners might enjoy knowing, I don't know if you know this, but the Barton Cottage in the movie of Sense and Sensibility that we're talking about is a National Trust property,
Oh.
that you can rent. So
Oh my goodness.
I know people who have stayed in that cottage by the estuary, like with the reeds and the hills, and it's an experience that you can buy. Which also, this movie, I say it's kind of the start of cottagecore on film because I think this
Yeah.
predates
Nancy
the
Myers,
Nancy
eat your heart
Meyers.
up.
Yeah,
Yeah.
but I think it predates her movies, but it's very similar. This cottage, its appeal is very similar to the cottage in The Holiday, which people also are constantly online over time, increasingly becoming preoccupied with as an idealized way of having a small home be everything you need. And yeah, and Jane Austen's very much about home. She's very much about owning,
Yes.
having security, having a place, big or small, that you can rely on, surrounded by the people that you love, is a very important goal. And like you said earlier, very difficult for women at that time because your choice, in order to get the home could often lead to what we'll talk about next, Pride and Prejudice and Mr. Collins. That I'm only going to get my home away from my parents if
Yeah.
I marry this toadish reverend who's shown up in town because I'm 27 and the bloom is off the rose, I'm being told, and this is it. So, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. That's was interesting. We were talking off air. We don't need to bring the conversation down about the world right now at large. And when I watched Sense and Sensibility, suddenly the beginning of the film really hit me about this idea of what happens after somebody dies. A son might get it and then screw over a relative. And if you don't have a husband or you don't have, I mean, it's getting more and more expensive to live in America. And I was watching this and thinking, wow, this still is everything that people are worried about, security and also just getting older. Sometimes people have had marriages that didn't work or relationships. And then do they pick the person who just fits and is, nice enough person, or do they hold out? And so these are questions, of course, through, all of our lives. So yeah, absolutely. And then, like I said, it perfectly lines up to Pride and Prejudice, which is both of our favorites. It has one of the best first lines of any book, for sure. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. And it's one of those, like you said, she had her 10 pages, her 20 pages. She just instinctively knew that is what you do. But yes, it's up there with, like, the opening of On the Road, or In My Younger and More Vulnerable Years, or, there's Gatsby. There's all these things that you remember, the opening line of 100 Years of Solitude, where he's like, was it a firing squad? But he
Her
remembers discovering ice or something. Like, it
last night I
takes.
dreamt I went to Manderley again. Like it's up there. It's a
Yes,
top
it's
10
up
opening
there.
line.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think Pride and Prejudice, it's like she was finding a rhythm. And this one, for sure, it is more of a traditional romantic comedy, but it's also a satire more of the people and the time. I think, like, she was starting to have some pretty strong opinions now that she'd been out in society and seen interactions. And we saw some of her sardonic wit, I would say, coming out in this one. And I love it. I love all the sisters. I also really admire the 1995 version, which is beautiful, the mini series. And but we're talking about the Joe Wright one, and I do really enjoy some of the changes they made in that. I mean, this is more of a grubby, they don't have their hair washed every day. It looks more realistic. There's mud on their hems.
There's animals walking, the farm animals walking through the house. It's chaos, right? It's sort of like pleasant chaos. It's like this is what life is like if you are not rich, like Mr. Darcy. And there's a book that came out after this movie, a long time after this movie, called Longbourn. And it's from the point of view of the servants in the house of the Bennet household. And it is very much about showing that this is showing you chaos. The beginning of Joe Wright's Pride and Prejudice, his decisions about what that house is going to look like and the family life will look like is immediately conveying both chaos and class. In a really effective way. So, because our understanding, like they're still well off compared
Oh,
to
yes.
the vast majority, but there are gradations by like like 1,000 pounds between them and Darcy. Like you could literally go and then it would be this size house and then it would be this. Like it's very, there's so many
Yes.
strata in society at that time between the, what we would now consider probably upper middle class, lower upper class, and then like the truly wealthy and the power in society that the truly wealthy have, the Darcys, the Lady Catherine de Bourghs, even a Bingley with the money coming from trade, the power that they have to make decisions that impact others, whether it's a proposal to a woman that literally does not like
Yes.
you. They have this innate power that comes from their standing in society and their wealth. And that is a really important distinction to get across that I think, although there are things about Joe Wright's movie that I wouldn't have done if I was a brilliant director, which I'm not. But there are also a lot of decisions he made cinematically that are really smart and really efficient. And the two things I think about this movie that really jump out is, I mean, I would love to have seen a Wuthering Heights directed by Joe Wright, because this
Yeah.
does have the swirling camera work and soundtrack. It's Dario
Overlapping
Marinelli, I think, that
dialogue
did
is
the
very
soundtrack to this.
Altman. Yeah.
Yeah. It's also just really lush and
Yes.
romantic, and it's filmed in such a striking, it's one of the, I think it's one of the most beautiful movies,
Oh,
and it's,
yes.
it really is. I mean, that's what I think one of the reasons it had its 20th anniversary re-release this year,
Yes.
because this is from 2005. It's one of Joe Wright's early movies. I think this is before Atonement, which I love the Atonement. I love the book and I love the
This is
movie.
actually his feature debut.
Oh, is it?
He
Okay,
had
yeah.
done television before this,
Okay,
yeah.
yeah. And it's just so cinematically striking that it wins on soundtrack and visuals.
Oh my gosh, yes. Dario Marinelli's score, also for
Oh.
Atonement, are just, he's one of the
He's
greatest
one
for
of the
sure.
greats. And I like if I when I was writing my Jane Austen books about people loving Jane Austen, if I ever use a soundtrack on a reel from the Marinelli soundtrack to this movie, like it would go viral. Like I would get like thousands of I was like, what's going on? And it was just because of Elizabeth on Top of the World. Like it would just be like this music that everyone loves. The other thing that he does, it's really interesting, if you notice that he uses an ampersand. Joe writes
Yes.
the title, right? I think that's the first time that this, but people write it now that way all the time.
Oh, yeah.
New editions of the book come out with the ampersand. It signals right away to the audience that this is going to be very modern, right? Very fresh. And then Emma has the period at the end of her name to, as if to punctuate it, like Emma's enough. Emma's the it girl. Emma's everything. So they're both making decisions about the titles, which I thought was really interesting, especially because they're classic titles. But the other thing he does is I don't believe, Jen, that there are opening credits, after
Yeah,
the,
we are just launched in.
you go straight in. And but what's interesting about one of the reasons I love the book Pride and Prejudice, it starts off with this couple when I was 9 years old reading it, this mother and father who are talking, and I remember thinking, gosh, they're just like my parents, because like she's nattering about what's going on, he's not listening, he's reading the paper. And then you meet all the daughters, and then you have another chapter. I don't think it's really until they're at the assembly and Darcy insults Elizabeth that the, I don't believe that up until that point, the narrator goes into Elizabeth's head. This is a technique in writing called free and direct discourse, where the narrator can pop into different people's heads and pop back out again. If you're reading Pride and Prejudice for the first time, I would venture to say you may not know that Elizabeth is going to be the heroine. You have your suspicions because she's her father's favorite, but she doesn't get to dominate any scene. It really starts off with the parents, and then it moves into the girls, and then it moves on to Mr. Bingley's come to town. And then it's that moment where Darcy rejects her. And what's interesting is that all the versions lately of Pride and Prejudice, they always start with obviously the heroine, because it's like, know your target market and play to them. And there are so many young women, I'm used to be one of them, that are watching this movie. I think I had a 2-year-old when this movie came out, and I remember rushing, like you said, with your experience with Sense and Sensibility, like driving like an hour to the town that was showing it and being away from like
Yeah.
my baby all afternoon or whatever. But there's this moment at the beginning where it's just Elizabeth with a book in a field. almost a morning misty field. And that's going to be very important later at the end of the film as well. But in that moment, she's a bookworm. She's so engrossed in her book. She's not looking around and she's in her own little world. And this, we immediately identify with her in this very, again, very effective way. And you're really on her side. And so he makes a lot of decisions that really work for a movie. That's what I appreciate about this version.
He might have gotten that too from television, because usually like the pilot show and the final show kind of echo or respond to each other. So yeah, that idea of the field is gorgeous. I love it. I love Donald Sutherland in it. I think it's good. You mentioned the parents. That is one change that, okay, so I recently did an episode on Buffy the Vampire Slayer with some friends, and we were like, uh-oh, we are now the adult age. And so we're watching this differently. And so maybe I'm starting to watch some of these a little bit differently, of course, and you always do with stories you read and books, movies. But when I was watching the 95 miniseries version, mom is so obnoxious and it's a little much and it's grating. It's like nails on chalkboard. And the father is like barely tolerating it, but wise. But in this one, you actually do see them humanize the parents a little bit more. You understand why she's doing what she's doing, and she does care, and even though she shows it in weird ways. And then the father also, in this one, I think he makes more mistakes than he did in the miniseries version, in his behavior. And I thought that was really good, rather than just have him be Jane Austen's dad, the
Yeah,
wise. Yeah.
more fallible. I thought it's Brenda Bleethen
Love
that
her.
plays Mrs.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought she's like the undersung presence in this movie, because I think, yeah, as I've gotten older, I have appreciated what she was up against, knowing that she has five daughters. They will have no money when the father goes.
No.
They're going to lose their home. And the dialogue is not always the most accurate in this version, to be absolutely
No,
frank.
exactly.
And that's probably one of the things about it that I have to always sort of, make peace with, to appreciate, because there's so much to appreciate. But she really conveys the desperation of this character, but her love. And there's a wonderful moment, in the book where she reminisces to Lizzie about her own days as a young girl loving a red coat, like loving a soldier, or
Yes.
finding soldiers attractive, and they giggle together. And that's always one of my favorite parts, of the book, because there are moments where she's clearly completely not reading the room or not reading the
Yeah.
reality, and she's in a lot of denial, similar to the mother in Sense and Sensibility, who also I think did an excellent job, that they're so blind to what a lot of other people can see, but the blindness is coming from love, especially love for the certain daughters, like the mother in this version,
Is with
this
Liz,
film. She's so besotted with Lydia, right? Because
Lydia,
Lydia is
yes.
her. Lydia is her. I'm sure she was just like Lydia when she
Yes.
was that age. And so she can't really see her for who she really is. And that's going to unfortunately lead to a lot of trouble. Like you said, with the father also making mistakes. These are very fallible parents, but they love
Yeah.
their children. And I think we all, when we watch movies, as much as family dramas are important, there is something also very enjoyable about watching a big family, kind of like the reason everyone loves to watch increasingly The Family Stone at Christmas time, or even a Meet Me in St. Louis with Judy Garland, which is like, I think, our favorite Christmas movie. There's something so enjoyable about watching a large, rambunctious family coexisting and having those moments together that I think makes for like a really, really pleasant experience at the movies.
Yes, absolutely, especially this time of year. Yes. Yeah, that's perfect for that. And I know also you mentioned lushness, and he talked about, of course, Ang Lee's Sense and Sensibility and Schlesinger's Fire from the Madding Crowd. There was a really beautiful version, a newer version of Far from the
Carey
Madding Crowd.
Mulligan.
Oh
Yeah, it's
my God,
gorgeous.
I love
Yeah,
that one.
it's gorgeous. Yeah.
And also he was going for some teen romances from the 80s, that kind of a feel. And I think he
Yeah.
did achieve that with this. I love the casting. I think,
Yeah.
they fill out the daughters great. Rosamund Pike playing opposite one of her ex-boyfriends, I guess, was
Yeah,
the
where
thing.
I
Like,
guess, because I couldn't remember if they were
yes.
actually like engaged while they were making the movie or had broken up just
Yes,
before.
that had to be a little awkward.
What I love about her performance is that she is very kind but not stupid, which is
Yes.
exactly how I think Jane Austen felt about the character. But on paper can come across as cloyingly nice and almost like unrealistically nice in the way that the mother is unrealistic about things as well. But Rosamund Pike, who can speak French, play the cello and went to Oxford, apparently must be like, I mean, obviously a very, very brilliant person. You can just see it on her face. And same with Matthew McFadden and Keira Knightley. These are really strong actors who can register so much with just the movement of their features. And although I don't, anyone who's been in the head of Mr. Darcy in Pride and Prejudice knows he's not the shyest, guy on the planet. He's got a very healthy ego. Matthew McConaughey made choices. I don't know who
Oh,
Jenner, who
Matthew
initiate,
McFadden.
sorry, McFadden
Yeah.
made choices. I don't know who. It could not be more different. I don't know who initiated those choices, but he could sell me swampland in Florida. Like he really can sell anything, that actor. I mean, look, is it
Yes.
Succession? Like he's so brilliant. And Keira Knightley is so wonderfully age appropriate. Like Kate Winslet,
Yeah.
very young when she's making this movie. Like I think she is the age of Elizabeth. I think she is like 21.
Yeah,
And
she's
yeah,
12, I think
and I
20
really,
when she got the
yeah.
Oscar
And I
or
think
nomination. Yeah.
nomination, and I think it's like, it's actually very important because you have to see how the effect of his dissing her at the very beginning is sort of the inciting incident, right? Like that's what kind of sets everything off. It's going to make her dislike him so much that she's going to almost want, like, gravitate towards Willoughby just in
Yeah.
order to put more nails in Darcy's coffin. Like she's not even aware, right, that she's doing this, but she's actually enjoying, like examining Darcy through Willoughby in a weird way. So it's very complex what's going on. Not Willoughby. I always do this. Wickham. There's two W's. So
Yes.
Wickham. Wickham in Pride and Prejudice is the bad boy. Willoughby's the bad boy in Sense and Sensibility. And
But
Wickham
they
is,
basically could be brothers or homies. They're so
they're
similar.
both,
Yes.
yeah, wonderful, wonderful narcissistic sociopaths. And
Yes.
lying their way through life and half believing it probably. But I thought that my understanding is, and I read this a long time ago, that the chemistry between Keira and Matthew is so strong in this movie. I think it's a real key reason for its success.
Yeah.
And I believe that they said that when they were filming, either rehearsing or filming in the Temple of Apollo, there was a moment where they almost kiss.
Oh.
I believe that there was a rehearsal session. At some point, I remember reading her saying that it almost actually happened between them because, and
They get
it's
so
not,
in the
they just
moment,
got
yeah.
so in the moment, but you can feel that when they're on the Temple of Apollo, which is a beautiful proposal scene where she's going to turn him down in the rain. All the elements are there. The long coats that they both wear at different points. It's very fantastical, and very romantic. And again, I would love to have seen what Joe Wright might have done with Wuthering Heights because it really is the highest level of visual romance moments between people that you can film. It really got them all right. And I have to tell you, Jen, when I saw the movie, I was not immediately enamored. In fact, I had a bit of a sinking feeling the first 25 minutes because I was comparing it actively to the Colin Firth, Jennifer Ely,
Oh, yeah,
1990,
of
which I
course.
95, which I love. And I remember I was just kind of, yeah, I'm going along. I'm like, it's good. And then there's that famous moment where he passes her into the carriage and clenches his hand afterwards. And I
Yes.
actually remembered the reaction I had in the theater. Like I sat up and I went, oh, and then it was like, we're off. And, I'm told, like I have a friend who owns a movie theater and she said like when they screened it recently, it was more in 2020, I think that they screened it. And women like literally gasp like at that moment. Like it's such a
Yeah.
heightened romance to this movie. And at the end when he comes forward, it's all so heightened that the British version ends, I believe,
Without a kiss.
without a kiss. And they actually in America added this whole
Yeah.
scene in the, because
I
they were
don't know
like the,
about that scene. Yeah.
I don't know. It's all made up. I don't need it.
No.
But if that's what people wanted, but apparently they felt that American audiences would really, really want to see the leads have this moment together at the end. So yeah, 'cause the thing about Pride and Prejudice as well, Jen, is one of my daughter and my favorite parts of that book is actually after Darcy and Elizabeth get engaged. There's these pages of walks that they take with different
Yes.
siblings and where they're just having their time together. And movies don't end like that, right? Movies end, with the kiss or
Oh,
they end with,
happily ever after. Yep.
but there's these wonderful scenes where they are kind of autopsying like how they fell in love, and it's really romantic, and you get that in the more film the TV adaptions, because it's, you know, it and actually that leads me to talking about Emma.
Oh, I wanted to quick say something though.
Yeah, sorry,
Yeah.
go ahead. I've
Oh,
been talking about
no.
my.
But anyway, as far as that goes, you're talking about the long overcoats and the way that, it was a little more earthy and organic. And it reminded me of Gillian Armstrong's Little Women adaptation. The way that Joe and the professor fell in love kind of seemed to be a similar vibe
Oh,
to,
I love that. I've never thought about that, but
yeah.
that's another movie we watch every Christmas Eve, and
I
that is
know. I love that film.
very, that's a beautiful movie, and you're absolutely right. That's so cool. Yeah.
And yeah, I forgot the other thing I was going to say, but yeah, anyway.
So, length. Pride and Prejudice and Sense and Sensibility are the exact same page length. They're about like 120,000 words. Emma is her longest novel. So by virtue of that, it should be the hardest to adapt. But I actually think Sense and Sensibility is by far the hardest to adapt because of the nature of the lack of dialogue, a lot of passive voice, a lot of stuff is being told to you, is happening, is just being explained to you as opposed to shown. And Pride and Prejudice, I think, is maybe the easiest to adapt because
Yes, the plot
it's
is
the
more
plot is just clockwork
cookie cutter.
perfect.
Yep.
It's smooth. It's efficient. It just moves. Every
Yep.
scene is there for a reason. There's no downtime. Like it's, you know, have this happen. Mr. Collins proposes. Now get Lizzie to Rosings to get him proposed to. Get Jane to London. Then get Lizzie up to Pemberley. Like it's just constantly moving its characters forward. And it's got a really great energy to it. And I think you see that in the very kinetic camera work that's being done in Joe Wright's adaptation. There's a lot of moments where the camera's very show-offy, maybe not, doesn't need to be, but the movie, it just keeps moving. And I really appreciate that about the 2005 version.
Yeah. As far as Emma goes, I have to say I was not a fan of the new one. The first time I saw it, I hated it.
Wow.
Then I watched it again. I like it a little bit more. Well, I like the actors. I love the youthfulness of it. I think part of it is when I was in college, I remember I had one of my advisors was a Jane Austen professor, and that was her love. And she said of all the films, and this would have been in the early aughts, basically,
Yeah.
she said Clueless is the closest to what she thinks Jane Austen was like, and her spirit, and inventing words and youth. And she said, I don't think it's going to get better than that. Like she had problems with, she's like, the other ones are fine. They had even made a Persuasion. They'd made a few others, but that was the one. And I remember talking to somebody at the school recently. And they're like, nope, that's the one, that they still hold up. And so I think that was hard. I also grew up with the Gwyneth Paltrow
Which I
version.
love, which I think
Yeah,
it's
it's a
my
little
favorite.
stodgy, but it's good. And then Romola Garai or Gary was
Romola.
Romola.
Yeah.
Romola,
I don't know.
was in a really good one with Johnny Lee
Johnny
Miller.
Lee Miller.
Yes.
I think that's a great one. And Michael Goff is the father, and he really,
It's the
I mean,
BBC one and it's
it's a BBC
terrific.
miniseries. It's four
Yes.
parts, and they really got into it. They could get, because it was four parts, they could get into it on a really granular level. There was, I really like that version. It's very faithful. What I appreciate about the new Emma is like, and I've never seen a second of Bridgerton, but my understanding is that this was coming off the heels of that
It
success, right?
feels
And
like it goes with that,
it
but I
feels like
like
that.
Bridgerton
Yeah.
better.
And then it feels like, I just haven't, I mean, I'm just, of all the things I've been watching, it just hasn't maybe one of them, but there's a real prettiness to the movie, but it's also very wacky. So I feel like the Emma Thompson is the version of Sense and Sensibility of these three movies that we're talking about today, that
Classic,
hers
most
is
classical,
most
right?
classic, the most wittiest, the most faithful. I think that the Pride and Prejudice is the most romantic and prettiest. And I just
Lush, yeah.
this lush and this new Emma is, it's wacky. And the casting, like everybody's like a little askew looking from what you might think they should look
Yes.
like. And there's a lot of like, I think some of them are like kind of like former models that have the most interesting faces. So I think there's a real visual, distinctive aesthetic going on in the new Emma, which is why I enjoy watching it. I feel like I get immersed in this very weird, artificial, wacky, almost Tim Burton-esque looking world, like with towering tea trays that could never exist in real life. And, I'm not, I love Bill Nighy more than, like, I
Oh
just,
my
I,
gosh,
you
he's
know,
probably my
but
favorite then.
he's not my idea of Mr. Woodhouse, but his energy is just so, I mean, he's just so charming. I think my weakness for this movie is the casting of Mr. Knightley, because I was very almost audibly opposed to the casting of Johnny Flynn, not because I knew his acting, but just because he didn't visually. I just see Mr. Knightley much more like a Jeremy Northam or a Matthew McFadden, like it just, like very tall and dark, handsome, kind of like Mr. Rochester almost. And I just really appreciated the energy of Johnny Flynn in this film. I loved his voice. I love the musical cues from Waller Bridge, Isabel, is it Isabel Waller Bridge? It's Phoebe Waller Bridge's sister that did the soundtrack. And so what I love about this
Isabel
movie are
Waller Bridge,
Isabel
yeah.
Waller Bridge. What
And
I love
David
about this,
Schweitzer, yep.
what I love about this movie is there are some really unique choices that help me look at it in a fresh way, which I just always appreciate. I will always, I think, prefer of all of them the Gwyneth Paltrow version, but their music is a combination of modern and folk and opera and country, and like it's crazy, the music. But each character almost has like their own little mini soundtrack that follows them along. And I think it's interesting because I think Autumn de Wilde, the director, had done music videos. I think this is her feature. This is her first film as well, I think. I think she had done music videos and other things. And music is used really interestingly in this movie to create humor and almost equalization. Everybody has a weird little musical soundtrack for their character. And for me as a listener, I love movie soundtracks. It's one of my passions. So when I see each of these characters having this funny little musical undertow to their behavior, it equalizes everyone in a way that is the message of the book, which is that how Emma treats Miss Bates at the picnic scene is, I think, the key scene in all of Austen's books.
Oh, for
Probably a
sure.
great thing, to sort of like, share with the audiences. If you haven't read Austen and if you've only seen the movies, the picnic scene in Emma is her message, which is like none of us are better than anybody else. And if we look better or have more power, it's a combination of factor some of fortune, some of which is beyond our control, some of which we earn, but it doesn't, there's enough luck in there. But the point is to never punch down and to use what you have to make a better community. And that is what Emma fails at when she teases Miss Bates and insults her in such a shocking way that nobody is happy. And it brings down the whole, you know, picnic that they're on when it happens. But it also, I think, shows like to Jane Austen, what Emma does at that moment is like just as bad as anything you could do. Like it was just bad on so many interpersonal societal levels. And it's
badly
a really
done indeed.
Badly done indeed. and it's a really important scene. And I think that what I appreciated with, you know, this new version was using music and other things cinematically to convey that each of these characters is flawed. Each of them is a little wacky. Like whether it's Emma's sister or Emma or Henrietta, Harriet, or the father, whoever, Mr. and Mrs. Elton, like everyone's a little wacky because we're all a little wacky.
Yeah.
And this is a world in which we should just recognize that. I have a friend who actually is the chair of the board for Chawton House, which is the place that Jane Austen visited when she was writing her books in Chawton. Her brother owned the great house. And my friend who's on the board there, she always says, and it's such a thing. She's like, the whole point of the books and the small village life is learning to live with the boobies, learning to live with, you know, the people among us who are foolish and aren't, you know, instead of like just learning to find your allies and the people that are like you, but learning to coexist with the people that aren't. And that's, I think, a big message in Jane Austen's books. And I personally think this movie does it pretty well because everyone just looks a little off. Everyone's just not quite what you think their character would look like. It's interesting to me. It's very, very democratic that way.
Yeah, visually, there is a lot of choices that are being made. And some of them, I think, are excellent. And then some with the bloody nose, you know, you're like, if I never see that again, I'm good.
I know.
But it kind of reminded me, it's interesting, I didn't even put it together with Bridgerton. But yeah, that definitely makes sense. Also, there was a film in 2019, The Personal History of David Copperfield, a new version of that.
Yeah.
And it seems like it kind of has a similar tone. It didn't fully work with me either. But one thing I did admire about this is that they really did decide, first of all, Anya Taylor-Joy has the great level of youthfulness, I think.
Yes.
She is the right age. She's like, doesn't know what she's doing. She's both smart and dumb at the same time. And so I think the girlishness in this movie is far more appropriate to Emma than we usually see these like perfect little ladies that come up. So that I thought was a good choice. You talked about how odd it is and people looking odd, and it reminded me of Jordan Harper, who's a good friend of mine, made a comment that he once in New York City, he saw Tilda Swinton in a store or something. And I said, oh, what was that like? And he said, she's a space alien. And I'm like, what? And he said, no, not like derogatory. Like she's different.
Don't look like
legal,
other people.
Elegant,
right.
But like,
odd doesn't mean unattractive. It's just they don't look like anyone else you've ever seen. Mia Goth is gorgeous, and she doesn't look like anyone else you've ever seen.
No, exactly. And he was saying that's kind of an actor thing, is they have big heads, and then we laugh.
They do. They have bigger. Apparently, they have bigger heads and bigger hands than regular people.
And oh, that's what I was going to forget on the thing with Pride and Prejudice is the eroticism of hands is a really studied thing. And Joe Wright uses it throughout, especially with Atonement. There's also eroticism of hands in Ong Lee's Brokeback Mountain. So that was a really cool way to get a little more sensual with Jane Austen and make it a little more palatable for the modern audience. But when it comes to, so you kind of have these odd ducks basically for Emma putting together. And I do, so it's like, yes, these are models and actors and people that you would not see in your neighborhood, essentially. And I think, so it's a little jarring the way they're all structured together. I didn't even notice that about the music. So that's, if I watch when I watch it
Yeah.
again, I will pay closer attention to that
Yeah.
because that's
Yeah.
always cool when they do that.
And also, I want to do a shout out for the screenplay of Emma because this book is 160 some thousand
I
words.
know.
This is almost a novella longer than the earlier two books that we were talking about. It is the second to last book she writes. She writes it before Persuasion. It gets published a year before she dies. And the screenplay for this was done by Eleanor Catton, who won the Booker Prize and is obviously a brilliant writer.
Yeah.
And what is very hard about Emma is because they consider it, though many people consider it to be the world's first detective story, because there are all these crazy clues buried in it, and highly recommend that people
Yes.
who haven't read it, read it and then keep reading it, because every time I read it, I find a new cue, a new clue. And there are many, many arcs in the book that make it so long, because there's first the governess gets married, and then there's, her friendship with Harriet, and then there's, meeting Mr. Elton, and then there's Jane Fairfax comes to town, and then Frank Churchill comes to town, and you have all these little mini arcs, and they're done sequentially. So when Jane Fairfax comes to town, Frank's going to show up soon after. That's on purpose for a reason. So that is like a clue in the book. And so everything in the book is timed a certain way. And I think the challenge for Catton was with the screenplay for this movie was to have to bust that apart and restrand these little mini arcs and have them overlap in ways that don't anymore, no longer yield clue information about what's about to happen or what's going on. I have to say, I think Emma Thompson's is the strongest screenplay, but I have to give a shout out for her screenplay because I think what she had to do and work with
Oh
was
my gosh, that's so much
incredibly,
work. Yeah.
incredibly difficult, and it worked. And because the scenes that they did retain, like you have to get rid of a lot of Emma that you shouldn't get rid of, but you have to if you're going to do a 2 hour and 10 minute
Yeah.
movie. The things that they kept in fulsomely and accurately and authentically. And the dialogue, a lot of it is not new in a way that it isn't Pride and Prejudice. And as a writer, I really appreciate what she did with what is a very long, brilliantly structured for a specific literary reason book. So I do think that that is something that I really appreciate about this new Emma.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I'm looking forward. I know there's going to be another Pride and Prejudice, and they're just going to keep making these, I think. And so, any other versions that we didn't mention, or other, of course, there's
Oh,
Persuasion, there's all kinds of things. I mean,
yeah.
you gave a shout out to so many.
I think the Mansfield Park by Canadian director Patricia Rosima from the late 90s, which I think again was Johnny Lee Miller is in. I think, and Harold Pinter, the great late great playwright, plays the master of the house of Mansfield Park. Sir Bertram, and it's a very dark and I think a very interesting movie. There are some decisions that are made that I don't necessarily maybe would like agree with, but not in a significant way. That is a very interesting movie. If people haven't seen it, I would recommend checking that one out too. But otherwise, I think we did cover almost all of them. The Persuasion with Kieran Hines. Kieran Hines gives to that 1995 Persuasion, which I think was originally filmed for television, I believe. He gives to it a very similar, wonderful, charismatic energy that's similar to Alan Rickman's performance. So if anyone loves Kieran Hines as an actor the way I do,
Oh, yeah.
I highly recommend, that version. And I do have to say that one of my novels was narrated by Rupert Graves, who plays in this new Emma, Mr. Weston, who marries Emma's governess and is in the movie. So for me, I have a soft spot
Oh,
for this
yeah.
adaptation. And that I do think Johnny Flynn's performance, because the Emma movie from 2020 came out like within the first few weeks of the pandemic.
Oh, yes.
And I remember being able to watch it streaming at home. Like you could pay to watch at
So it
home,
would
and
become a comfort movie for people
it
for
became a comfort
sure.
movie, and his performance definitely inspired like a character, in that same book. So I have a special affection. And I think in the end, that's what is important about Jane Austen books and the movies is everyone has their favorites. Everybody has a favorite adaptation. And also they get generationally shared, like you and I both said, like, you know, seeing Sense and Sensibility with our moms.
Yep.
And so there's always nothing like the first time. And I think with Jane Austen, a lot of it is when it hits you, when you get to it, what you get to first. And I think each of these movies taking place now, over like almost a 25-year period, 95 to 2020, each of them, I think, strikes a different generation differently. And I think that's why they'll be able to keep adapting it, because now the women that fell in love with the Colin Firth version and showed the Keira Knightley version to their kids, now those kids are, you know, in their 30s and maybe have children to show whatever Netflix comes up with. So that's the really fun part. It's kind of like my, as a period drama lover, and a lover of classic literature, this is all kind of like my Marvel tentpole franchise comic stuff.
Yeah. I would take this over Marvel any day.
Yeah, just keep making different versions and same characters, I'm good.
Yeah, absolutely. And I did like some of the newer BBC versions. There was a great Sense and Sensibility with Jana McTeer, who I love also because she's a tall woman. So usually they don't get the work as much. So it was cool to see her. I also really liked the new Persuasion with Sally Hawkins. So I would recommend that one too.
Yeah. You're right. The Sense and Sensibility with Janet and Hattie Moynihan and, Charity Wakefield. And then the, Persuasion with, it's Rupert Penry-Jones, I think, and Sally Hawkins, were both made around the same time, about 18 years ago now.
I know.
It feels like a long time, but really gorgeous. Those ones from 2007, 2008-ish are very worth looking out for too. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. It was a good time period for it. Cause I also loved, the Jane Eyre that was made around that time.
Oh, I love the Jane Eyre with Toby Stevens and Maurice Wilson.
Yeah.
For anyone that loves Jane Eyre and you haven't seen that, you have to check that out.
It's my favorite. Yes.
It's brilliant.
Well, Natalie, this was so good. And it's also like the 250th anniversary of Jane.
Big year.
Yeah. So this was wonderful. You have to come back with another topic anytime. I always learn when I talk to you. So this was
It was so much fun to talk about these movies and talk about Jane Austen. And thank you so much for having me on.
Of course.
I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research, equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as $1 per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the free music archive. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching.
This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.